Hey everyone, and welcome to Risky Business, your weekly information security news and current affairs show. My name's Patrick Gray. We'll be chatting with Adam Boileau about all the week's security news in just a minute, and then we'll be joined by Proofpoint's Sherrod DeGrippo in this week's sponsor interview. She'll be talking about a few things about how the Emotet hobbyist community helped take the botnet down, about how TrickBot is tracking after last year's military and law enforcement takedown efforts. Plus, we're going to have a chat about BEC. That is coming up later, but first up, of course, it is time for a check of the week's security news with our good friend Adam Boileau. And Adam, of course, the big news that broke, I think it was like a day after we published the last podcast, is that the Emotet botnet has been nuked. It is gonskies.
Yeah, a global operation called Operation Ladybird, put together by a bunch of law enforcement and private sector and all sorts of people, have clamped down and taken out a bunch of the command and control servers for the Emotet botnet. Ukrainian law enforcement went and knocked some doors down and picked up some gold bars and a whole bunch of discs by the look of things. The word seems to be that the Emotet botnet has been pretty comprehensively wrecked. And obviously the comparisons to the takedown of TrickBot, which wasn't super effective. It's going to be interesting to see how this one goes, but it sounds like they did a pretty comprehensive job.
Yeah, they sure did. And the video is classic, right? I think, really messy sort of hacker hovel full of gold bars and cash and caseless PCs,
It's exactly how I imagine,
it's funny, actually. Kevin Beaumont had a funny tweet on that because he was saying, people picture these really swish digs, and really it's like caseless PCs resting on empty cans of baked beans,
Exactly.
So the videos were pretty funny. Brett Winifred in this week's Seriously Risky Biz newsletter actually got some great detail on aspects of this takedown that I don't think were emphasized enough in a lot of the other reporting, chiefly that the informal cooperation in the private sector on this one was really above and beyond what we're used to seeing.
Yeah, I mean, there's been some, I guess, historical precedents for, researchers and private sector companies working together. I'm thinking like the Stuxnet analysis, for example, or even going back as far as Conficker, of private sector companies and researchers working together, both in their kind of personal capacities and also in a corporate capacity. And it's good to see that kind of cooperation, kind of coming to the fore again, because, a lot of people care, do these jobs because they care about the safety of the internet at large. And we really are at our best when defenders can cooperate like this.
Yeah, I do feel like this one was a little bit more than we're used to seeing. And Brett got some great details. Like there were some network operators who could, seize C2 IPs. And then there were the C2 IPs that were located in countries where you're not going to get cooperation. So some of the network operators just basically black-holed routing to those IPs. They nulled them, and which caused a lot of Emotet bots to basically fall back onto the C2s that law enforcement did control. There were just a lot of factors here where people were just really quite informally just doing things like, hey, maybe, reach out to this person and we can do that. Instead of people waiting for court orders, they just did it, right? And that's it's new to this extent. Let's put it that way.
Yeah. And it's also really nice because the relationships that people build doing those things will then go on, to have a whole bunch of other positive effects. We saw that, some of the people that worked together on Configer went off to do, kind of wonderful things, after that because of this. So there's a whole bunch of benefits, other than just the takedown for this kind of, this kind of cooperation.
Configer. Now that's a name I haven't heard in years.
Probably still out there shelling XP boxes.
Yeah, pretty much. I wonder if there's still code red. If you plug in a NIC, if you just plug into the internet, I wonder if you see it coming from all the Windows NT4 boxes that are still being spun up in China,
Almost certainly.
And TrickBot, as we mentioned, it is still kicking along. We're going to talk to Sherrod DeGrippo in this week's sponsor interview a little bit more about that. But it seems like TrickBot is down, but definitely not out. And meanwhile, the latest variant actually has MassScan baked into it. They're getting all fancy so that they're actually port scanning like corporate environments and reporting those port scans back to the C2. So, to know what sort of lateral movement they're going to be able to do in those environments, it's kind of cool trick.
Yes, it certainly makes a lot of sense and suggests that they're branching out from the, just pure Active Directory. There's a lot of, internal admin services that have been great for shells, for, pen testers and all sorts of internal attackers for a long time. So, makes sense. And it's interesting that it's now worth it to them, to go and do this kind of lateral movement and recon and all of that. Whereas, you know, before, I guess the, you know, business case didn't make sense.
I would have thought launching Mascan from the average corporate workstation might trigger some IDS sort of alerts, but hey, you know.
You'd certainly hope so, wouldn't you?
Oh, man. UK police have arrested a 20-year-old man for operating a SMS phishing service, basically, but they were sending a lot of SMSs, you know, for all sorts, on behalf of all sorts of people, scammy SMSs. So that's good news.
Yeah, there seemed like a sort of set of, you know, phone-related services. So there was like SMS, you know, bulk sending and phishing, and there was also some services for doing like phone call-based one-time auth, you know, multi-factor auth phishing, or, you know, we'd phone up and, you know, an automated script would prompt people to enter in their 2FA codes, which then the attacker would get back via some, you know, web API and be able to use it to log in with creds that they'd stolen. So, yeah, quite a, you know, technically sophisticated operation, but OPSEC sophistication a little bit low. Krebs has an amusing screenshot of the guy who runs the service called SMS Bandits just listing his location as Birmingham, which is, turns out where he was. So, not the best there.
Not the best. And yeah, I should mention too, the reason we're talking about these stories together is because in the Imitet case, there was two arrests too. And given the absolute crickets out of the Imitet botnet since, it would tend to suggest they got the right guys.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, we will see. There was some interesting details about them taking out like the backups as well. I think there was maybe the Dutch police were talking about the fact that they got into the backup system, figured out how it worked, and then, you know, RM'd those as well. So certainly learning some lessons from the ransomware operators there.
Yeah. Oh, good job to everybody who was involved, by the way. We should just say that because it's not often you see such a clear win, right?
Yeah, I mean, they've clearly, you know, learned a bunch of lessons from some of these efforts in the past, and just, you know, a one very fast, comprehensive strike is definitely the right approach here, and they seem to have done a really good job of it.
On we go, and yeah, look, this week's newsletter, sorry, I mean, I talk about it a bit in the show, but this week's newsletter was like really, really, really good. Brett did a whole bunch of fantastic reporting, and he's been looking more into this Excellian issue. Now, regular listeners would know that some organizations in Australia and New Zealand have said that they were breached via their Excellian file transfer appliances. Now, this is a device that even the company that makes them says is legacy and shouldn't be used. But like we're looking at this and saying, well, it's obviously not just Australian and New Zealand organizations that have been affected by this. And indeed, we're starting to see some headlines from US organizations that have been affected. It looks like attackers have been exploiting these things pretty widely, right? And I'm surprised it's not getting that much attention outside of APAC.
Yeah, obviously we had a few high-profile victims here and it came out all in kind of one go. Like one breach here, one breach there kind of gets lost. But in this case, you know, we saw a bunch of organizations all at once being hit by it, or that it was identified in a bunch of organizations all at once. And that made for some, you know, some headlines here. But yeah, the fact that it hasn't been picked up elsewhere is interesting. But clearly there are a bunch of people who are getting these things owned. And I gather yourself and Brett have been, you know, watching the showdowns and spotting these things gradually disappearing as people get the message. But
yes,
you know,
that's him. I mean, you know, his headline is that the appliances are being thrown out, you know, windows. You know, get your concrete umbrellas, people, because it's raining Excellion FTAs. So, yeah, and Brett's been the one. He's been keeping an eye on Shodan and just watching the plug getting pulled pretty far and wide. I've actually got some audio from Brett. Here it is.
You might have seen in previous newsletters that a few victims of these attacks came forward in Australia and New Zealand. Now we're starting to see the first US-based organisations come forward to announce that they too were compromised this way. We're also seeing a lot of what we would call juicy targets decommissioning their systems at a rapid rate at the moment. And if you are one of the organizations that is using one of these file transfer appliances, they're about 20 years old, they look to be pretty buggy, we kind of recommend that you should be thinking about decommissioning them as well.
Well, actually, I'm going to go a little bit further than Brett there and say, absolutely, if you have one of these things, please remove it from your environment post haste and, yes, throw it out the nearest window. Would you agree with that assessment?
He was being a bit gentle there, yes.
He was being a bit gentle, yeah. Now, look, this is the same company, Excellian. They make a product which is, you know, more of an updated cloud-based product. It can be, you know, you can buy it as a cloud service. I'm not too sure that I'd be completely confident in the security of that product either. Do you have any insights there?
Well, I mean, obviously, when you look at how vendors fix security flaws in their product and how they address past ones, that gives you an indication of how they're going to fix them in the future, and the track record for the sorts of bugs that they've had and how they've fixed them, does make you question the quality of the engineering. And I'm not sure of the legacy of the Kiteworks there.
Well, they say it's a completely new code base, but again, that's not really necessarily comforting when they have demonstrated some bad engineering practices in the past.
And I mean, even when you say that, I mean, in the end, these appliances are going to be Linux boxes built out of all sorts of open source stuff. And there's just a lot of, there's a lot of complexity. And, even when it's a fresh build, even if it is, maybe it's an acquisition from another company, I'm not quite sure. But the quality of engineering and the rigorousness of your QA testing and the process by which you go about disclosing the vulnerabilities and helping your customers is a pretty good indicator of whether or not you should be trusting, an appliance like this on the perimeter of your network.
Well, or even as a cloud service, right? Because they
or
do
even
have,
as a cloud service.
Yeah. So, I mean, Brett and I have spent a lot of time talking about this particular story because it is one of those really interesting things where, say 10 years ago, there were compliance requirements for the transfer of large files. Dropbox was kind of a bit of a mess back then. Right? Like the early days of Dropbox, it wasn't exactly confidence inspiring, as an enterprise product. Now there's alternatives like Box, and you've got, your Google Drive and your OneDrive from Microsoft and whatnot. Like there are alternatives now, right? Whereas, back then there really weren't, which is why people bought this stuff in the marketing for this Accelion FTA. They called it a secure content firewall, right? And it's not secure. It's not. It's got SQLi in it. Now, look, you mentioned last week that it is post-auth, but I've had listeners point out that depending on the config, you can often register for an account with one of these things and that gets you past that initial auth barrier. And certainly I'd be stunned if it's just like the one or two headlines we've seen out of the US. I'd be stunned if this wasn't actually a much broader campaign that's affected quite a lot of their customers.
Yeah, you certainly get the impression that it was a pretty coordinated. I mean, the fact that we saw so many organizations in New Zealand simultaneously does suggest that it was not a individually targeted, that there was a bunch of the stuff going on widespread. And there's zero reason that you would constrain that to Australia and New Zealand. Like the same thing will have happened elsewhere. It's just we happened to have a critical mass of reporting here that made it kind of bubble up. Whereas elsewhere in the world, it's probably just along with everything else that's being breached. And in the end, that's what we've seen in the last year or so, is that any of these appliances that are on the edge of your network that are security enforcement points are a clear target, and there is a heap of bugs to be found because so many of them do kind of predate sensible modern thinking about how to build these things and support them in a a secure way.
GuidePoint Security have done a write-up on the web shell that at least one set of attackers was using, and it does actually do a little bit to conceal itself in logs. But you if you've got one of these things, or if you've had one of these things in your environment, you need to have a look and see if it got owned, and you need to decommission it. I mean, it's not often that we sort of try to get on our high horse and give people actionable advice on this show, but I think in this case it's kind of justified, right?
Yeah, I think the advice is pretty clear that if you have one of these FTAs, you need to turn it off.
Yeah.
And then you need to go do the triage of how much stuff got nicked out of it.
That's right. And important organizations use these things. Anyway, I think we've kind of done our bit. So we can move on to the next story.
Flogged the Accelion horse.
Yes, that's right. Although we did have a line, I don't know if it survived the final edit, but we did have a line in the newsletter saying, apologizing for flogging the dead horse, but we think we detected a bit of a pulse. So there's the dead horse might still be just twitching a little. So anyway, Reuters has a report saying that they've got sources saying that Chinese hackers apparently were using bugs in SolarWinds to hack into a US government payroll organization, the US Department of Agriculture's federal payroll agency. It's like something called the National Finance Center. But yeah, it looks like, SolarWinds can't take a trick, right? Because they've had a whole campaign named after them. And now it's like, it turns out that, okay, they were used as a vector in some other attack, and it sort of justifies these headlines, right?
Yeah, but it's a little bit mean, I guess, because, I mean, the attackers in this particular case were already in the environment and were using SolarWinds to move laterally, which is a thing that,
the media is incentivized to publish stories with SolarWinds, the word SolarWinds in them right now.
Which, hey, you know, maybe it's good brand recognition. I don't know. But yeah, no, the I mean, this is a good example. If you go and look at a particular thing, you know, who knows what you're going to find. Turns out there's Chinese hackers in there as well. But yeah, SolarWinds by design provides code execution on a bunch of devices that it monitors. And I mean, even like when we use SolarWinds to move laterally across, you know, a boundary towards the end of last year as well. So this is a technique that, you know, a bunch of adversaries have used because it's such
So there you go, Reuters. Why don't you write that up? Beardy New Zealand guy did it as well. It doesn't make for as sexy a headline, does it, when it's a beardy metal guy from New Zealand?
Yeah, I want my headlines.
Great story from the Associated Press looking at how US courts have responded to the Holiday Bear campaign, because of course those attackers were going after court filings and things, right? Like sealed documents, whatever. So now it looks like in some courts, which are handling things like, you know, intelligence related trials, lawyers are having to deal with like just interacting with on-prem computers that aren't connected to the internet, which is going to be a drag. But, you know, I mean, what other option do you have?
Well, I mean, it's a good response, I guess, you know, to say, hey, we can't trust our network. Let's go have a standalone machine that handles all the filings. The downside, of course, is that machine's going to have every USB stick in the world plugged into it and probably going to get owned anyway. But yeah, I mean, it just kind of shows the difficulty in responding to, you know, when everything's networked, when everything's tied together, all the files are, you know, all over the place and for all sorts of critical things. The process of responding to that, it's just super, super difficult. Yeah, I mean, if they reduce the air-gapping documents, then, you know, let's hope the cameras in the building aren't pointing to it, and let's hope there's not a printer involved, and you know, air gaps are hard too.
This next story, Adam, someone in Ron Wyden's office is still very curious about what exactly happened to Juniper back in 2015. For those of you who don't remember, there was a supply chain attack against Juniper's NetScreen products. Attackers hacked into the NetScreen source code repos, and they adjusted the curve points on the controversial on their implementation of the controversial dual EC DRBG random number generator, right, which would allow passive network observers to decrypt VPN traffic. Now, a lot of people say that NSA deliberately had that dual EC standard sort of ratified so that they could deploy it everywhere and then, you know, passively decrypt people's comms because they'd set the curve points. But either way, like the attackers in this case definitely did fiddle with the curve. A lot of people think they're Chinese. The attackers were Chinese in origin. But now Ron Wyden and a group of lawmakers led by Ron Wyden is actually asking NSA what steps it took to secure defense networks after that breach, right? So I think this is an attempt to elicit more information about that whole thing, both on the dual EC side and also on the Juniper side, and to find out more. And I'm all for this. It's fascinating. I can't wait to see what else we find out here.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there's so much hidden stuff in our past, you know, of this industry, and it is good when the stuff finally does get dragged out so that we can see and go back and, you know, readjust our understanding of what happened. And, you know, certainly if it did turn out that there was some kind of relationship between these aspects, you know, that the NSA had caused them to deploy a less than ideal.
Well, they did. I just think that's because the NSA is a somewhat dysfunctional bureaucracy in many regards, not because they're like super elite planners who trojaned an RNG that they themselves were going to use in a cunning ploy. You know what I mean? Like, I just think it was one of those things.
It does seem like a more sophisticated plot than you'd necessarily expect from a government agency. But yeah, like if there is some relationship, and certainly like understanding the trade-offs, but you know, for the whole equities process, for all of these, you know, not just vulnerabilities, but all the, you know, the way this whole ecosystem ends up being kind of moved around by parties who have different interests, understanding how all that works together and having a great example of that would be a useful thing to contribute to the conversation. But yeah, mostly I'm just nosy too, right? I mean, we all like to understand, you know, who got owned. And I mean, certainly, you know, Juniper could have done more to explain what happened. But I mean, they were always very kind of closed-lipped about that whole thing. And yeah, I'm nosy too.
Well, that assumes they even know what the hell happened, right? Which, I mean, we've got some funny stuff to talk about later on that. oh, God, this is a horrible story. Amnesty has found that an Israeli surveillance equipment maker was selling its wares off to a security agency in South Sudan. That is the National Security Service, which is known by some in the country as the Ministry of Torture. Way to go, you assholes.
Yeah, I mean, this is just it's a horrible story, and you know, it makes you feel bad about being in this industry at all. And, you know, there's a lot of examples in the past of this kind of, you know, surveillance technology being misused by governments. And, you know, in this case, it's a pretty clear example. And obviously, Amnesty have called this one out because it's such a clear example, of a place where, you know, we have, you know, the Israelis will say, for example, that they have export controls that are meant to come to. This is a good example of where those controls have just not been effective. Mm. And then, of course, there's a tie-in to a U.S. parent company as well. So it's just a bad look for, you know, the companies and the countries involved. And, you know, I wish we didn't have to have stories like this.
Yeah, me too. Links are in the show notes if you want to check that out. Now, some good news. This report is from Lily Hay Newman, but a few people have covered it. Apple has really improved the security of iMessage in iOS version 14 to the degree that even Project Zero have had a look at it and given them an attaboy.
Which is really good news. I mean, iMessage has been a bit of a sore point for a few years because it's so full of features, and you know, the way that it renders the messages has just been kind of the source of a lot of bugs over the years, and some of the really nasty, you know, like NSO group, no interaction, remote exec your phone kind of bugs. So Apple has reworked some of the underlying components of that. So for example, there's a bit more rendering occurs in sandbox environments. They have added some kind of runtime layer, like address layout randomization, where it can re-randomize the addresses of libraries that are used by iMessage without requiring a reboot, which is a good thing. It'll make some exploitation of memory corruption bugs a bit more complicated. So a few things that, you know, that kind of exploit mitigation stuff, you know, has a very long kind of benefit because it, you know, kills generic techniques that make exploitation possible. So yeah, certainly makes things a bit harder, and it's nice to see, you know, Apple going back and addressing, you know, some of these sore points.
Brian Krebs has written a really interesting feature here. It's really about the fallout effects of, I guess you'd call it cyber-enabled fraud. You know, this isn't really a cybersecurity story, but it's looking at a lot of this like unemployment benefit fraud and how eventually, you know, the people who are the victims of this fraud start getting bills from the government and stuff and being told to pay back money that they never requested. And it's just a good feature.
Yeah, this talks about, I think, mostly the state of California, but there's a bunch of examples of this around the US where victims of identity theft, because monetizing identity theft is a thing that, you know, cyber criminals have spent a long time working on. And one of the avenues, you know, we've seen the tax return ones, but one of the avenues they've been doing here is requesting unemployment benefits for people impersonating their identities, getting a whole bunch of money. And the amount of money is significant. Like, we're talking, what do you say, like fully 10% of the unemployment benefits paid out in California, which is something like $11 billion, was fraudulent. And then the people who've had their identity stolen and used in this way don't know until they subsequently get tax, get their tax details and find they have to now pay tax on their unemployment benefit because, well, I don't know why that's the case, but that's another story. But yeah, just a really significant, like much more significant amount of money than I had imagined would be the case. And just really pernicious because now going back and saying, you know, getting a reissued tax summary from the state to say this was fraudulent is probably not going to happen in time to file your tax returns. And Krebs kind of talks through all of the complexities this causes for people. And it just sounds like a miserable, miserable thing to be stuck in the middle of.
Yeah, it's interesting, right? Because in Australia and, to the best of my knowledge, New Zealand, you know, the type of welfare fraud that we get are people who, you know, make birth certificates for their cats and start claiming benefits from them. You know what I mean? Like, it's just, it's like that old school dumb stuff, like not massive at scale, very sophisticated identity theft. But geez, what a problem. Because once you've got this problem, it's kind of hard to get a handle on it.
Yeah, I mean, I can't imagine, you know, what they're going to have to do to deal with it because the scale of it is a problem. And then also the way it kind of interacts with, you know, federal tax and the state authorities and all of those kind of, you know, and of course with COVID, everyone's kind of, you know, everything's, all those state apparatuses are pretty busy with other stuff as well, working from home and that kind of thing. It's just a really, really complicated situation to try and unwind.
Yeah, Yeah. Now, lock up your VMs, people, because they are under attack. This is awesome. This is just a case of like, well, you know, some ransomware person thinking, well, why is no one ransomwareing VMs? And then they've gone off and done it.
Yeah, and there's been a couple of juicy bugs in VMware's hypervisor that would allow unauth access to, you know, to the resources of the hypervisor.
Was it in the hypervisor itself or something around the hypervisor?
Well, I mean, the ESX hypervisor is kind of like a cut down Red Hat Linux underneath, and then they were using some service discovery protocols that the hypervisors on, like the underlying Linux underneath, uses to go and discover other components of the VMware plumbing and so on and so forth. So it's kind of like, you know, it's not the hypervisor, but it's the support infrastructure around the hypervisor on the individual virtualization nodes that there's been a bunch of bugs in. But yeah, they've been breaking into those and then ransomwareing the VMs, you know, from the hypervisor down rather than doing it up. And of course, most people have, you know, if they have AV or they have something that's going to detect ransomware operators tooling, it's probably running in the VMs. You know, some people have obviously AV up in the hypervisor, but it's scanning down into the VMs rather than the hypervisor itself. So, you know, nasty situation to be in. And probably a good example of why we've seen like the trickbot dropping Maskanthen we talked about, you know, finding internal resources that then you can go and leverage for more effective ransomwareing. Although I think in this case, this wasn't the trickbot crew. This was the RansomX gang innovating. So good for them.
Innovation. We love innovation. another one from Lily at Wired. And it's just funny, right? Because if you're a Facebook advertiser, you can specifically target categories named Army, United States Air Force Security Services, you know, stuff like that. So, I mean, if you were a bad actor with a Facebook ad account, you could probably do something with that, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly one of these, like, it's not really a bug. Like, this is intended operation of Facebook's targeted advertising platform. But obviously, you can use that for things that are nefarious. And I think, you know, Facebook's responded with some kind of changes where they said, oh, well, some of these kind of granular targeting groups weren't particularly widely used. We've kind of aggregated them. But in the end, this is just what Facebook is for, right? That's their business model. And so the fact that you can use that for evil, I guess, is, you know, sadly expected behavior.
I remember it was many, many years ago, some guy messing with his roommate by targeting him with like very personal specific ads over Facebook. And the thing is, Facebook had already established controls to prevent that, but he managed to bypass them by creating some group with demographics that only this person would fit. Do you know what I mean? It was like, it was very, very funny and freaked the guy out like big time.
Yeah. I've seen a few friends do similar things over the years.
Yeah, like stop eating my sandwiches, you bastard, like stuff like that. Now, we got a report here from an Israeli threat intelligence company called ClearSky, who I believe, you know, we got to talk about this one with the caveat of, you know, some of their analysis can be a little hit and miss, but they do have a report here on the group Lebanese Cedar, which is linked to Hezbollah, which looks pretty interesting and certainly describes the type of attacks that Hezbollah are known for, chiefly going after telecoms metadata and stuff, because I believe they actually have pretty good counterintelligence and they use that data to try to hunt down people who are cooperating with foreign intelligence services.
Yeah, the report talks about them using bugs in, you know, the sorts of software we've seen in the past, Atlassian, Confluence and Jira, or Oracle Fusion Middleware, but targeting, you know, telcos around the region. And they've got, because of the way that their campaign works, there's some kind of fairly consistent tooling used between the attacks, and the researchers have been down the process of, you know, kind of identifying, you know, a number of victims. And they're, you know, the sorts of people you would expect, you know, Vodafone Egypt, Etisalat in the UAE, Saudi in Saudi Arabia. So, I mean, a bunch of telco operators in the region, it's pretty clear, I guess, how you would use, if you can get call data or location data, from the inside of mobile operators, it's pretty clear how you can then go and use that for a bunch of things that are, you know, useful for a group like Hezbollah. But, you know, on the other hand, it's still a pretty sophisticated intelligence operation to go break into the telcos and then, you know, use this stuff in a timely manner.
Yeah, it is. But imagine catching a bullet because Vodafone Egypt didn't patch their Confluence box. You know what I mean? That's the world we live in. It's just crazy.
Yeah, that's the world we live in, man.
Jeez. It sure is. All right, what do we got here? We got Google has stripped another CA from its cert store in Chrome.
Yeah, this is a Spanish certificate authority, Cama Firma. Google's going to throw them out of the cert store. We haven't seen any word from Mozilla or Microsoft or Apple yet, but I mean, generally these CA, generally the browser operators do operate as a block because it's in everybody's best interest to not have bad CAs. Mozilla's catalogued in their, kind of their bug tracker where they catalogue CAs being bad. They've got a whole bunch of records of this particular CA just, kind of doing dumb stuff and, issuing sub-CA certs to third parties that they haven't told them about and, things that probably do deserve to have you thrown out of the cert store because we just have to trust CAs. There's no room for bad actors in this group.
Yeah, the problem is the quiet achievers, right, who are lurking in those stores that don't do the obviously dumb stuff, but then... Yeah, I think as Joe Slowick pointed out on the show a couple of weeks ago, occasionally there's those BGP hijacking events where a whole bunch of traffic from like Lockheed Martin will go through China. And you think, well, if they don't have access to a CA, like what's the point of that, right? So
Exactly, yes. That's a conclusion to draw.
Yeah, what else have we got? Yeah. this is funny, actually. One person's influence op is another person's marketing campaign. Digital marketing campaign, Adam.
Yes, the Belgian government has been considering deploying a 5G mobile network and, of course, are concerned, like many governments, with operators such as Huawei. There was a whole bunch of Twitter accounts that popped up and started, having opinions about the safety of 5G networks run by Huawei. And yes, it turned out that a bunch of those had ties back to, sites that have articles written by Huawei, were retweeted by Huawei staff. It does look a little bit like... maybe more on the influence campaign side than the marketing side.
But I mean, it looks identical to like, I'll occasionally like a sponsor, I'll record something with a sponsor, right? And then I see similar sort of Twitter behavior, right? Promoting the podcast that I've published. Yeah. And most often it's these things where there are like incentive programs for staff to retweet company related tweets and whatever. But it's just really funny how... when it's Huawei, it's an influence op, but when it's, security vendor X, it's just like shitty marketing, right? Like, anyway, that's what occurred to me.
It's a valid point.
some ransomware crew, fledgling ransomware crew called Phonix Crypto have released their master decryption key and said, we're getting out of the ransomware business. I don't know really if this crew was getting much traction anyway, but it's always weird when something like this happens. You just sort of wonder why. Did they feel bad? Did they feel the heat? What's going on?
Yeah. It'd been interesting to see, what the story behind this is. And at least in this case, like they did release the master keys and they released a decryption tool and those do appear to work. Like it's not just a scam. They said they would like to use their skills for better things to help people, which... you want to believe it. You want to take it on face value and go, yes, maybe they have turned over a new leaf and good for them if so. But, it's kind of, these stories always, is it really true?
I don't know. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, as you say, it appears to check out, right? So, but it's just, motivation's big question mark there. Who knows?
Yes, exactly.
For all we know, it was a rival crew, hacked them and pretended to be them releasing all the keys. that's what we do. Some good news here. Google is funding a project to replace Mod SSL with a different module called Mod TLS, which is going to be developed in Rust, which is obviously going to result in a better outcome for everybody. So yay, Google.
Yeah, I think this is a smart move. I mean, obviously that Mod TLS code base goes back quite a long way and is a lot more important in the world now than it once was, 20 years ago when it got written. So makes sense to, a new implementation. Of course, getting a new implementation of anything crypto right is difficult. Will take a little while. Rust, of course, is a good choice to do it in so we can avoid some memory corruption flaws. But anything that complicated and new, hopefully we've learned a bunch of our lessons over the years on how to build this kind of software well. And it will probably be better than what it's replacing, but...
Well, I mean, that's the thing, right? Like, Mod SSL is, it's not exactly the latest hip thing, right? and it's important. No. It's important. It's good.
It really is.
Yeah.
On the other hand, it'd be interesting to go and say, what bugs have we actually had in Mod SSL that really were impactful? Like, is this a good place to spend engineering dollars versus something else? And I'm sure that, people that are planning this project have done that analysis.
Yes.
It would make sense, right? You don't want to have, same bugs, different implementations. So, yeah, we want to avoid those. And they're smart people. I'm sure they have done that.
Yep. Now, on to the lulls for the week. Sonic Wall, right? So last week we were talking about how they announced that they got owned by Odays in their own products. Then they came out and said, actually, we're not sure if it was Odays in our products. We think it might have been Credfish. Right? And then NCC is like, well, here's an O'Day that we found people exploiting in the wild in your products. I mean, maybe it was that. And then my favorite exchange through all of this was like on Twitter, where SonicWall replied to NCC Group saying, can you DM us so that we can confirm receipt of these details? And then Ollie Whitehouse replied to that saying, we have had confirmed receipt from yourselves. So yeah, just an absolute trash fire of comms out of SonicWall. And they're like, yeah, we got owned by an O'Day in our products. No, we didn't. And NCC's like, well, you might have, here's some. And SonicWall's basically like,
Yeah, I mean, I guess there are some takeaways for that. If you're a SonicWall customer, maybe you shouldn't be. And if you're considering a new Soho file, maybe don't buy a SonicWall. It's just such a mess, you know.
This week's show clearly not brought to you by SonicWall or Excellion. Actually, to be honest, even if it was, we would probably say the same thing. Well, we would. Yes. We would. What else? The British Mensa website got hacked and like hacked pretty bad. Not so smart now, are you?
Yeah, their website is currently down, saying 503. Apparently, a couple of their like tech people resigned. One of them says he quit because they weren't hashing their members' passwords and that they had been having that conversation for several years now.
Members club for those with an IQ of 148 above. What does that tell you about metrics and testing, huh? Why do I like this? Why does this make me happy?
Look, I mean, the Schadenfreude is an important part of our business.
It is.
that's what I am feeling right now.
Now, Skateboarding Dog this week is actually a fantastic write-up by Ron Amadeo in Ars Technica, taking a look at Huawei's Harmony OS. This poor journalist signed up for the developer program. It's so funny, this read. I don't know if you read the whole thing, but yeah, he had to submit like a scan of his passport, and it was like a really intrusive process to actually get enrolled in the developer program. And then when you're in it, you're like streaming this OS, obviously to a rig, which is like a test harness with an actual phone plugged into it, where you click through to the settings and it shows you that it is basically just Android 10, kind of not even really reskinned. And the artwork on this article, it's not often that we single it out for praise, but it's basically like the little Android robot wearing a Groucho Marx nose, glasses and moustache. But walk us through this one. This was just for the lulz. It's great. It's a great story.
So yeah, of course, with you know export restrictions towards Huawei, they said make our own operating system, I guess the fact that this is just a fork of Android probably doesn't come as a huge surprise. You know, whether that's enough for them to be able to go ahead, you know, with a phone that's you know operates only in China or something. Maybe this is you know they just scrape off the Google bits, you know, plaster on some Huawei Suns and it'll be fine, but.
Yeah, I mean, probably it's just Android with the integration to a lot of the Google services removed. But it is pretty funny when Huawei are putting out statements saying, this is not a copy of Android. And then you click through to the like system info in dev info and it says Android 10.
I mean, maybe they'll gradually scrape all those bits off as well. But yeah, it's a pretty funny... funny, but not at all surprising. And on the other hand, like if we saw them go away and actually write a whole new mobile operating system, I'm sure everybody at the NSA would be throwing their hands in the air with delight because it's going to be a complete mess. And we saw that with like the Samsung one, Tizen, something like that, which was just like Enlightenment, you know, the open source window manager from the dawn of time, bodged together terribly. So, you know, if they were going to build their own new one, I'm sure, you know, they could probably do a worse job than reskinning Android.
Yeah, the sound of popping corks would be emanating from Fort Meade, basically. And that's something we've talked about too, about this whole thing of like, you know, oh, we're going to build our own OS. It's like, yeah, go. Like,
good luck with that, buddy. Good times ahead. Good times.
Well, mate, that is actually it for this week's news. It's been a pleasure to chat to you as always, and we'll do it all again next week.
Yeah, cheers very much, Pat. I'll talk to you then.
That was Adam Boileau there with a look at the week's security news. It is time for this week's sponsor interview now with Sherrod DeGrippo of Proofpoint. Proofpoint, of course, is best known for its email filtering products, and Sherrod is a senior director of threat research there. She joined me to talk through a few things. She'll tell us more about the Emotet takedown. She'll give us the latest on TrickBot status and talk a little bit about business email compromise. Here's Sherrod explaining that Emotet, as best as Proofpoint can tell, is completely and utterly dead for now.
At this time, we have seen zero Emotet in email in terms of distribution, nothing. Now, there is a big difference between distributing via email, obviously, and the life or death of the actual botnet nodes, the C2, the backend, and everything like that. But our point of view indicates that, yeah, Emotet is gone at this time. And so a lot of what I'm thinking about is comparing this to the TrickBot takedown from the end of last year. And that was not super effective. We continue to see TrickBot from the usual actors starting up about 3 or 4 weeks after all of the news releases and all of those things. So TrickBot was not the same as this. TrickBot was kind of, you know, knocked down, but I'll get up again, if you remember that song from the 90s.
I do.
And Emotet, it really seems like is down for the count. I mean, they really seem out of the game.
Well, yes, and I think it was one of your colleagues who remarked to me that they, the operators of Emotet, made the critical mistake of not being Russian.
Yes, whoops. And then one of my colleagues also mentioned that Emotet potentially accounted for 5% of Ukraine's gross economy. So who knows what's going to happen to Ukraine's
GDP. Here comes the recession. Yeah, exactly. So it looks like, you know, I mean, one of the things we mentioned in the newsletter, and of course we spoke about it at the top of the show, you know, one of the things we spoke about was this ad hoc cooperation that seemed to spring up between law enforcement, you know, governments, threat researchers, network operators. It seems like everybody just sort of pitched in a way that they wouldn't have in the past, right? Like in the past, people would have been too nervous. Oh, I can't just block those IPs because, you know, you tell me to. I'm going to need a court order. It seems like people have had enough and they're prepared to actually act just using their heads, which is wonderful and kind of, it took too long, but it's wonderful. I just wondered if you had any thoughts on that.
The Emotet, so the threat research community has always had, you know, a collegiate academic approach, pretty friendly, but the Emotet community is the sweetest and softest community of of threat intelligence researchers that I've ever seen. There's just such a sweet friendship, especially with CryptoLamus and everyone tracking it. I won't name any individual names, but you know who you are. It's a soft chat. You know, you go into the info sharing rooms for Emotet and it is very soft and sweet. And it's almost a group of, you know, hobbyists that the hobby is destruction in the end. Like, we want to see that taken down. But the approach has always been, people working on Emotet have been very sweet to each other. It's a very embracing.
So that sweetness,
community.
They radiated that sweetness out to network operators and whatnot and touched them with their sweetness. So you think it might have been just the dynamic of the people who are sort of working on this might have been a factor?
I think it's that. I think that many of the people that worked on Emotet were very well placed, highly at ISPs, at research orgs, connected with law enforcement, and then are trustworthy, right? You know, there's people in the community that you build a trust with them, and a lot of those trusted people were part of that working group. And if you're ever going to do law enforcement action against a threat of the past 5 years, Emotet's the one to do it against.
Now, we absolutely should point out too, you're basically management, right? At Proofpoint.
Oh, yes.
But there's one thing that you still liked to get your hands dirty on, and that was Emotet. I mean, you know, you speak about these hobbyists. You're speaking about yourself.
Yes. Okay. So I do consider Emotet one of the things that I actually have a special affinity for, that I work on in terms of tracking and understanding what's going on day to day, because I am also responsible for block at Proofpoint. So part of my role is to make sure that we are blocking threats, which means anyone who's responsible for blocking Emotet could not sleep. I mean, every day, is it back?
Well, and it was good at evasion too, right? Everybody tells me that it was kind of a difficult one to, like, there's whack-a-mole and then there's like hyper whack-a-mole, because Emotet would be just back in a different form very, very quickly, and it would be tuned. The people behind it seem good at tuning it to evade detections.
Absolutely. And so when you're trying to block something like that, you're doing it hour by hour. And when they're creating evasions for things like sandbox or detection, you're pushing your choice to get around that evasion out to the sandboxes, out to the detection mechanisms. They see it. They make a change hour by hour. The most recent campaigns from Emotet, which I think were January 23rd, 24th, around that time frame, were leveraging CAPTCHA-style passwords as an image in the body of the email saying, this is the password to open your malicious document that contains Emotet. And that's very difficult to deal with, even with fantastic OCR, doing OCR on a caption image of a password.
Then you're playing the spammers game, right? Where you're the one actually trying to bypass captures, right?
So exactly.
They're using your own tools against you.
They love to get you engaged in that too, right? Like they want you constantly working on it because
they want to impose costs on their adversaries.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. So you mentioned the TrickBot, the takedown was less successful. I mean, that seems to be the general consensus, but no one seems to have really an opinion on, you know, how successful it has been. I mean, every day there's an article each way. You know, there'll be an article saying TrickBot's still around and, you know, nothing touched it. The takedown, cyber command, you know, it powers on. And then you'll see another article like the day after that saying, you know, TrickBot greatly diminished by these actions. I mean, what's the truth here? Do you have good insight here? I mean, I guess it's a bit difficult because you're very much on the email side of this.
Right. And so that is something that specific question of has this law enforcement action been effective and to what degree has it been effective is something that we also track and want to answer. So in January, there were 8 campaigns from TrickBot, which is, and this does not include Emotet dropping TrickBot later. These are specifically first stage TrickBot from TA-547, which is a different actor than Emotet. And We saw 8 campaigns in January. We saw a little bit fewer than that in December. The volumes are down. The amount of campaigns are down, but it's still on par with something we would consider a commodity regular crimeware threat. I don't think anyone should stand down or say, hey, well, you know, there was 8 campaigns instead of 12, so big victory. It's not.
No, but it's enough of a reduction to have hurt them, though, I guess.
It's enough of a reduction to have hurt them. It's not enough of a reduction to reduce the amount of workload it brings us.
I wonder if it's enough to stop them from attacking the sorts of targets that people were getting very nervous about, like hospitals and things like that. I mean, is there any evidence that their targeting has changed?
No, and they were not doing really specific targeting. They weren't. TrickBot's not a threat that we associate with a specific vertical or a specific type of target. It's very broad.
I guess the problem is it wasn't even so much the targeting, it was what was happening afterwards, right? The fact that operators would come in and then deploy ransomware into those environments and whatever, but it's a complicated old business model. So what else is going on too? We got you for a couple more minutes. BEC, ransomware, all trucking along as usual?
They're trucking along. BEC is definitely something that we're really focused on. It's very strange to me. It's coming from burgeoning markets like West Africa. They're combining things like malware, Credfish, doing BEC, getting into vendor management systems, issuing fake invoices. It's almost, it's one of those exercises, like a thought exercise. If you could be anyone and you could send any kind of email and you could do anything, what would you do? And they're really getting creative. And they're doing it, yeah.
Yeah. And it's interesting, right? Because the way you speak about it, it's like this fledgling BEC economy in places like West Africa. It's like, I mean, I can tell you're borderline impressed with some of the stuff you see. It's inevitable that'll happen, but yeah.
Yeah. And it's almost like, you know, I don't want to speak too far out of turn, but it does have some of the early hacker kind of vibe to it. It does kind of feel like, look, we're just going to throw stuff at the wall until it sticks. Like, you know, the late 80s and early 90s where people said, I just got access to some technology. I kind of know how it works, but not completely. I'm just going to try some stuff and see what happens. And then we get guys like Hush Puppy who are raking in potentially millions of dollars flying on a private jet. There's a picture of him with a Louis Vuitton jacket with a Louis Vuitton blanket on a private jet. So these BEC actors, one, they have style. Two, they're working really hard and they're combining technology to basically do social engineering at scale. And just raking in the bucks.
Hush Puppy got arrested, though, in the end, right?
He got arrested, then he got out, then he got arrested again. He lives a very fantastic life. I can't wait for the movie.
Yeah, it sounds. I mean, neither can I after talking about all of that. And ransomware is just trucking on as usual. No changes in the landscape there. I haven't seen as many headlines, but that's not usually a very good indicator of, you know, the true state of things, because a lot of this stuff goes unreported. But it's been surprising how many high profile cases I haven't seen so far this year.
I'm worried primarily about healthcare and municipal government, so like city government.
Yeah.
I think those are going to continue to be targets. And then, you know, remember the old, you know, Tired and Wired from Wired magazine?
Yeah.
Ransomware on a single machine is Tired. Ransoming an entire business's ability to do business, Wired. And then ransoming a whole city. Man, that's
Galaxy
the dream,
brain.
I think.
That's the Galaxy Brain one.
That's
right?
The Galaxy Brain.
That's the extension of that meme, Sherrod. Come on.
Yeah.
All right, Sherrod DiGrippo, thank you very much for joining us in the sponsor slot this week to have a bit of a chat about the Emotet takedown, about the latest with TrickBot, about BEC, about ransomware. It's been a pleasure to chat to you. And we'll chat soon.
Thanks a lot, Patrick. Great to talk with you.
That was Sherrod DiGrippo there with a chat about the Emotet takedown and a bunch of other stuff. You can check out Proofpoint at proofpoint.com. Big thanks to them for being a sponsor. And that is it for this week's show. I do hope you've enjoyed it. I posted a soapbox edition the other day with material security, by the way, and that is an interesting one. So do go check that one out if you missed it. I'll be back next week with more security news and analysis. But until then, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.